Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Five years later. Chapter 1. Porcelain. Red rectangle, sphere, law, crescent moon. Treble clef, yellow circle.
Jason sees the symmetrical black ink lines point in four directions away from their blossoming center, which holds a bright red rose. They are points of a compass growing out of the sensuous petals. A compass rose.
The image of the compass rose is a tattoo that sits on the surface of skin, filling the frame of his mind's eye. The motionless body of a woman reclines on a divan, beautiful in her deathly repose, eyes open. Liquid ruby puddle of blood beneath her. A streak of red runs down her cheek and drips onto the floor. As the frame widens, the whole room comes into view. Many windows appear on the outside of the room, across from the doorway. Latticed, wall-high, translucent warehouse panes. Outside the panes, another figure stands. Features obfuscated by the prism-like refraction of the light through the leaded glass. The figure's arm is extended forward, pointed toward the woman on the divan, holding a pistol. Behind the divan, across from the glass-refracted gun person, a figure stands framed by the doorway. It is a man. Initially, the person is unrecognizable, just a dark cutout in the doorframe, tall, sandy brown skin, dark hair. Then the features of the figure in the doorway pixelate into a known face with his eyes fixed on the dead woman in the room. Jason's own face.
Just a dream.
Ironically, the image in his dream of a compass rose, an artistic embodiment of directionality, disoriented Jason. It was a strange dream. It felt so tangible, so real. He had visualized a vivid scene depicting a dead woman in a warehouse, a gun-wielding murderer's face obscured by the translucence of window panes, and he was present in the scene, watching from the doorway.
Did I dream my thought lock sequence before the vivid dream with the compass rose tattoo, the dead woman, the murderer, and me witnessing?
Jason asked himself as he lay in his bed thinking about what the dream meant. With a foggy mind and a pounding headache, Jason sat up in his bed.
I got faded last night.
Yesterday had been the 3-year anniversary of Anton's death. The loss of his friend, colleague, and partner had ripped a hole in his heart that never seemed to heal. He thought that if someone could look at a snapshot of his life at that moment, they would see a wreck, a friendless, lonely, forlorn lawyer, an isolated Manhattan lush. But somehow, he had recently met someone whom he had not driven away, Alyssa. Their chance meeting had been organic, not a date arranged on social dating apps or by sliding into DMs on Instagram or one of the other big socials. He grabbed his UD from his bedside table. His lock screen displayed a notification for a text message. He blinked his thought lock code and unlocked his UD with a mental command. The text was from Alyssa.
I had a blast meeting you last night, Jason. I'm glad fate brought us together. We should totally meet up again. I hope that the Saturday morning court appearances go quickly.
Jason noticed her quip about fate. Romantic relationships had been difficult to maintain for him lately. He was angry, damaged, closed off. He could not prioritize others over the pursuit of justice for Anton. Nevertheless, he wanted a life partner, someone who empathized with his sense of loss and to whom he could open his heart. Someone like Anton. Perhaps Alyssa could be that person. He sat up in bed and mentally commanded Branch to draft a return message, which populated in the text screen.
Likewise, it was great to meet you by chance. We should meet up again.
He set his UD down, thought locked his branch so errant thoughts would not cause unintended transfers of data, and allowed his mind to wander as he reflected on the previous day and the evening that followed it. The long day in court had drained Jason of all his energy. The courthouse had become a toxic environment since Anton's death. Ever since the viral storm of outrage on the socials from Jason's release of the footage showing Anton's killing by the NYPD, cops had harassed, taunted, and spread lies. They whispered veiled threats with sneers as they passed Jason in the hallways. Prosecutors hated him for revealing the rot of corrupt police infecting the NYPD that many did not want to admit. When people recognized him from the socials, podcasts, or the news, they accused him of being an enemy of the people for his attacks on police, or they lambasted him for being a criminal himself. But Jason persisted. He would not let the NYPD escape accountability. They killed Anton simply for fitting the vague description of a black robbery suspect. Then they covered it up. An anonymous message, sent through an encrypted UD messaging app, alerted Jason to bombshell footage which had been deleted from a nearby bodega's security system hard drive, then mysteriously restored to the system's archive. He had not expected to find any recordings. He figured the police would have already collected and destroyed it so nobody could use it against them. It was a common tactic used by corrupt cops. Even now, when his brain forced him to visualize the traumatic footage, a sensation of pinpricks covered his skin. Anton's EV BMW pulling over to the curb, the driver door opening with the two officers barking commands at him, with guns drawn. When Jason closed his eyes, he could see the 18 muzzle flashes and the look of disbelief on Anton's face when the barrage of bullets hit him. Frowning, Anton's eyes seemed to ask why as he stared at his palms, glazed in the shiny red jam of his flesh, before his lifeless body crumpled and his blood pool expanded across the pavement. The lump in Jason's throat tightened when he pictured the police hovering over Anton's body, deliberating calmly before one of them trotted to the rear of his police cruiser, pulled a gun wrapped in a cloth and a knotted baggie of brown powder from the trunk, and planted them on Anton's still, contorted frame. The NYPD investigated the incident internally, but Jason learned that they had not obtained nor evaluated the footage from the bodega, so when he tracked it down, he posted it. The video went viral. Jason rubbed his puffy eyes from the edge of his bed.
I'm hungover.
The day before, the weight of Anton's death seemed to press down on his body and heart with more intensity than it had in months. He had drifted in the tide of the evening, as he often did, trudging from the New York Supreme Court building east of Tribeca into the iconically narrow Manhattan dram shop called Alley Cat's to be alone among millions of others.
It was Anton's favorite spot,
Jason reflected. Each time he and Anton had gone there, Anton would comment on the deep nut-brown wood bar with beautiful gradients of wood grain brushed along its length. The first bourbon Jason consumed was Angel's Envy, which had been Anton's go-to. As Jason slugged his bourbon, he reminisced about his times with Anton. It had been at that very bar that Anton had convinced him to get Branch.
Why wouldn't you get Branch?
Anton asked.
It makes life so easy. My work efficiency blew up after I got it.
His speech bounced rhythmically.
The physiological readouts are a game changer. They helped me tweak my habits to get super healthy.
Jason swirled his glass.
I'm old school, my guy,
he replied.
It took like 6 years for me to upgrade from smartphone to UD. I still carry cash.
You're literally the only person that I know who has bills in his wallet. Does anyone even accept paper cash anymore?
Anton asked, raising his eyebrows, half smiling. Jason shrugged with a grin.
I'll defend cash. It still works,
he said.
But I'm not so sure I'm ready for Branch. Injecting computers into my bloodstream and getting implants under my skin is bananas.
I think I know where your hesitation comes from.
Anton stroked his chin and narrowed his eyes as if in deep thought.
Security. You're afraid your data could get hacked.
You're right.
Come on, Jay. You may be a privacy wonk, but let's be honest. You're just scared someone's gonna see your nasty browser history.
Anton slapped Jason's shoulder playfully, his bright white teeth visible in his open-mouthed laugh. He then wrapped one arm around Jason's back, shaking him slightly as Jason's head bobbed side to side, lips pressed together.
But you don't have to worry about any of that. Thought Lock works.
Anton released Jason and swigged his bourbon.
You're convinced, huh?
Hell yes I am,
Anton exclaimed.
I did research on its security before I got the cellbot injections and micro-disc implants. No pen testers or cybersecurity researchers could find a vulnerability. Truly, there's nobody that could hack it. If its security was shit, I wouldn't have gotten it. Even D-Rock gave it her blessing, and she's one of the most talented computer forensics people in the city.
Anton said, referring to their firm's investigator and friend, Derica D-Rock Ojiflor.
Even if Branch is secure, I don't trust Arbor,
Jason said.
I got their vizzies like everyone else. That's all I need.
You don't have to trust them to leverage their products to improve your life. Tobias's case was so long ago. You can let it go. Join the times.
5 years back, around the time Branch was released, an engineer for Arbor named Remy Darden was shot to death in an alley. Jason and Anton had represented Tobias Blackburn, the young man accused of the killing. Tobias was acquitted by a jury after Jason and Anton sowed doubt about Tobias's involvement. But Jason suspected Arbor was responsible, though he had neither proof nor concrete evidence to confirm his suspicions.
Maybe you're right,
Jason sighed.
That's the spirit, my guy.
Anton set his tumbler on the beautiful wooden bar and applauded histrionically.
You don't have to like Arbor. All I'm saying is it's been 5 years since Branch's release, and nobody's been able to hack it. That's something. 5 years is an eternity in tech. It's fun, too. You ever control a drone with your thoughts? And Branch Gaming is wild.
Memorable conversations with his dead friend occupied Jason's thoughts as he sat with an arm resting on the bar, other hand grasping his bourbon.
Anton, my guy, I still love you. And I miss you.
Jason discreetly poured a drop of bourbon onto the floor of the bar as a libation.
I should have been there that day. Maybe you'd still be alive.
He pulled the tumbler up to his face and poured the remaining amber fluid down his gullet before leaving Alley Cats for a location less haunted by spectral memories. He had decided on a dimly lit Manhattan bar called Brick and Mortar. A disco ball rotated slowly above the dance floor, appearing to project vibing points of dazzling light invisibly tethered to its many reflective mirrored panels. The bar had a crowd of mid-20-something persons dancing around with champagne flutes, glasses of wine, or colorful cocktails with herb sprigs. Young men in collared shirts or jeans, or V-neck tees and slacks, held snifters with bourbon, whiskey, or dark rum, as others palmed cans or bottles of beer in front of their chests as if they would be used to parry attacks directed at their hearts. Some had UD vizzies on, reading messages relayed to the optic displays by their UDs, or letting the lenses hide their wandering gazes. Jason was overdressed with his light gray suit, tan dress shoes, textured white French cuff shirt, silk tie, not loosened, and colorful maroon silk pocket square growing out of his breast pocket. He did not feel old, but having just turned 32 last year, the crowd did not make him feel young. As Vapor Soul and Melodic Deep House issued from the bar's speakers, a woman approached the bar between Jason and a baggy-eyed young man, who Jason guessed was a finance type who never stopped chasing money. The young man sat with UD Vizzies propped up on his head, hunched over his drink, as if he had lost unfathomable sums of cash minutes before entering the bar. Jason peeked over his shoulder at the woman. She wore a black cocktail dress speckled with the gliding dots of light reflected from the disco ball, brown hair hanging above her shoulders. She turned and looked at Jason.
I recognize you,
she said.
You were the attorney that defended Tobias Blackburn and got him acquitted for the Darden murder a few years ago. I followed the trial on the socials. Heard you on some podcasts.
Jason nodded.
Good eye,
he said.
You're right.
I don't know how you do it. Defend criminals,
she said.
Did you really think Blackburn was innocent?
Yes, and I still do,
Jason said.
Just like I said at trial, I think someone else murdered Darden and got away with it. By sheer chance, Tobias was in the wrong place at the wrong time near the crime scene.
Everything happens for a reason.
She sipped her wine. The phrase upset Jason after having ruminated about Anton's life and death for the past several hours. In Jason's mind, the phrase insinuated that the unjustifiable murder of Anton, an exemplar of goodness, success, and loyalty, was acceptable in the grand scheme rather than a fluke of happenstance. Instead, Jason believed that Anton's murder was the product of bad luck, racism, and corrupt policing, not fate.
When you said everything happens for a reason, it made me curious to hear a stranger's perspective on a philosophical question.
Her eyes narrowed slightly.
Okay,
she said, wary yet curious.
What's the difference between chance and fate?
Jason turned his hand upward, forearm still on the bar, in a subtle gesture of curiosity.
Whoa now. That's intense for a Friday night, isn't it?
Her tone changed from indifferent to playful, and she smiled, revealing bright white teeth.
You should introduce yourself before asking such a deep question.
Jason,
he said, corners of his mouth upturned.
Alyssa.
They shook hands.
After we introduced ourselves, the night is a blur,
Jason thought, laying in bed with a headache and a fog in his mind. Parked at the bar, Jason and Alyssa had discussed destiny and circumstance. Alyssa said she believed in fate, which explained why everything happens for a reason.
Would Alyssa understand my misgivings about fate if I told her Anton's story?
Ultimately, he never mentioned Anton. They talked about their careers, they talked about the city, they talked about music they both loved as the disco ball rotated hundreds of times. They joked, teased, and commiserated. They sipped whiskey. A song with a forward-leaning beat and a melodic synth emerged seamlessly from the previous song, and Jason stopped talking to point upward in recognition of the music.
I love this song,
Jason said with whiskey-amplified exuberance.
Me too,
Alyssa exclaimed.
But you're the first person I've ever met who knows about it but me. It's from like 2012 or 2013 or something. I can't believe it's being played right now.
He enjoyed Alyssa's company. He had not experienced true happiness in a long time, and he did not want to ruin it. When they had parted ways for the night, they kissed.
I hope fate brings us back together,
she had said. But now, sitting up in his bed, fond thoughts of his night with Alyssa dissolved and were replaced by images of the dead woman with the compass rose tattoo from his dreams.
Didn't Alyssa mention something about dreams last night?
Jason thought. She had said during their discussion about chance and fate the night before.
Dreams are glimpses into your own fate.
Bullshit. Dreams cannot be glimpses into fate, because fate doesn't exist.
His UD alarm chimed, interrupting his introspections. He unlocked his thought lock and mentally deactivated his alarm. He needed to go to work. His thoughts shifted from his adventure with Alyssa and the dead woman dream to the judges, prosecutors, clients, and court staff with whom he had to interact professionally for the Saturday morning arraignment appearances. Before leaving his condo, Jason hooked his sunvisees over his ears and onto his nose. He removed his rose gold ear dots from their carrying case, pushed them into his ears, and then, through just a passing thought, activated the play music function on his UD via branch. He wore a heathered navy blue suit, a navy and gold silk tie, and a matching pocket square, with dark dress shoes that complemented his belt, chestnut skin, and meticulously sculpted dark hair. He stepped out of his building, which was situated north of Spring Street on the border of the West Village and Soho on King Street. The intense sun shined between the giant skyscrapers and apartment hives of people. Its heat instantly cleared his head of the hangover, like steam dissipating from a room with a suddenly opened window. As he walked to work, he thought again of Alyssa's statement from last night.
A dream is a glimpse into one's fate.
The theory struck Jason as ridiculous as he thought about his own dreams.
What does the compass rose tattoo mean? Why that image at that particular time?
He pushed the thoughts from his head.
Just a dream, no need to dwell.
Jason's gait matched the rhythm of the music playing in his ear dots. The sidewalk flew under his leather shoes like a concrete treadmill belt as he dodged throngs of pedestrians. Eye taxis, black cars, yellow cabs, scuffed box trucks, and luxury sedans jockeyed for better positions in the narrow streets. He paused to appreciate the luxury of walking to work.
When he had moved to New York, he imagined that 15 years hence, the city would have hover cars, floating buildings, and high-rises somehow incorporating trees, like metallic vertical forests. He imagined robots roaming the city, self-driving cars, and bullet monorails.
The New York of his imagination only partially aligned with reality. The future was built on the city's layers of history. The intersection of human memory and imagination attracted people to its impressive skyline, premier museums, and packed public transportation. People could live in the present moment or a moment in the past, and the fortunate or the wealthy could live in the future. Strands of time, place, and history were woven together by shoddy pavement, steaming manhole covers, heaps of accumulating street detritus, and the smell of rainwater flowing through storm drain grates along the curb. With one look, Jason could see Art Deco buildings with detailed artistic inlays, grandiose architecture, and sculpture from more than 100 years ago. Towering reflective skyscrapers that stabbed the sky like spears of ice cast giant sword-shaped shadows on the nearby buildings and streets. Arcology complexes seemed to hover over the city, their massive rooftop naturescapes as wide as full blocks containing stands of transplanted hardwood trees, climbing vines, colorful flower gardens, streams, and neatly manicured grass, visible through glass biodomes as transparent and thin as bubbles. AI taxis weaved between these immense buildings with machine-like precision, seeking patrons to take to new places, and delivery drones fluttered between buildings in apparent choreographed synchrony only possible through instant signal communication. Their passengers sat quietly watching the buildings zoom by, new and sharp like crystal glass or old brick that crumbled like a stack of cookies, or staring at their UD screens that illuminated their faces as they fed prompts to AI large language models like ChatGPT, or ordered AI agents to execute menial tasks like hire task rabbit humans to fix doors or toilets or contract maid services to mop their kitchens. Jason pushed past the lines of people outside of the courthouse and into its lobby, where armed deputies with stern faces herded the court-going masses. The deputies ushered Jason around the metal detectors, then he walked into the elevator bay. At that moment, his UD vibrated and a message from D-Rock populated in his visies. I'm pulling threads to find connections between Darden's murder and Arbor, like you asked. Nothing major so far, but I found a side comment Darden made to a journalist at a conference shortly before Branch's release, days before he died. In response to a question about the significance of Branch's release, he said, "If it's secure, it will be revolutionary." The comment was never published and seems to have been overshadowed by his killing. The large brass elevator doors opened, and Jason packed into the lift with seven other people.
If it's secure,
Jason thought.
Did Darden have reservations about Branch?
He mentally commanded his UD to respond to D-Rock, and he watched the words appear in his visies as he thought them.
Good stuff. Keep digging.
When the elevator pulled upward, Jason felt the jolt of inertia in his guts, and again, for no reason in particular, the image of the compass rose flashed into his mind, sweeping aside his ruminations about Arbor.
Fate or chance,
he thought. Chapter 2. Beat Organ. Easton. A dapper middle-aged man walked along a dirty street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Vape pens, cigarette butts, and broken glass lay discarded along the curb and against the buildings. In his path, a brisk wind blew a plastic grocery bag across the street like an urban tumbleweed. He dodged the gasoline and oil-slicked puddles as he strode down the pocked sidewalks. Easton Card's sculpted silver hair remained still, even when strong gusts pasted his indigo chalk-striped Gucci suit against his body and dislodged the collar of his Armani camel-colored overcoat.
A pin was fastened to his suit jacket's lapel, keeping it firmly fixed to his chest in the breeze. The pin depicted two shapes, an equilateral triangle and a simplistic star made of intersecting line segments that touched the top of the triangle. Together, the two shapes looked like a bright star hovering above the apex of a pyramid. He passed by a series of warehouses converted to communal art spaces and bars with murals that injected bright color on his way into an industrial sector with dilapidated buildings. Weather-beaten signs advertised businesses like Rossi's Heating and Plumbing, DY&T Construction, and Quick Lube and Body Shop. Cavernous potholes, crumbling concrete on curbs, and smudged graffiti tags on building facades contributed to the perception that this part of Brooklyn was largely ignored by the mainstream, a stark contrast to the glitzy opulence of the Fifth Avenue Arcology Row in Manhattan, the nouveau riche vibes of Long Island City in Queens, or the bustling energy of nearby Williamsburg. Easton's apparent confidence, expensive fashion, and general resemblance to the actor Idris Elba seemed more appropriate for those New York neighborhoods favored by high society. He stuck out in industrial Brooklyn like a spring tulip in a dead grass field. Easton's mauve and gold silk scarf fluttered like a banner as he turned from the sidewalk into a fenced-in warehouse complex. He crossed the asphalt plain between the buildings, ruminating on the secrets he had been keeping from his niece, Rose, which had been tormenting him over the past several months. The time was swiftly approaching for him to discuss it with her, considering the secret was a prediction of his impending death. He arrived at a brick building with a red door which glided open as if expecting him. At the top of the door was an emblem matching the pin on his lapel, a pyramid and star symbol representing the Pyramid Club, the business he owned with Rose. As soon as he crossed the threshold beyond the red door, the dimly lit chamber brightened to reveal a long and narrow corridor. On the far end, an enormous bank vault-type door protected the club's inner sanctum. The reception hall beyond this corridor was illuminated by a pyramidal glass skylight reminiscent of I.M. Pei's work at the Louvre. Black and white checkered square tiles spread across the floor of the open hall. On the far side of the room, two wide curved staircases led to a second floor landing. On the ground level underneath the landing, two large oak doors divided the reception hall from the lower house of the club's auditorium. A diverse collection of art decorated the walls. Swirling inky animal portraits by C.E. Scott flanked haughty queens and dukes by Branzino and Jan van Eyck. A surrealist dreamscape by Carlos Solis fooled the beholder into thinking it was a giant portal into an alien world. Pixelated digital art by Rafik Andal and Marsal Karam danced on their screens alongside the colorful shapes, streaks, and amorphous splotches painted by Joan Miró. Easton admired the Pyramid Club's art acquisitions as he moved through the space, which distracted him momentarily from his lingering anxiety.
"Hello, Easton,"
purred a deep but vaguely female voice in the room.
"Hello, Song,"
said Easton. He preferred to speak out loud to Song, the self-aware and autonomous artificial intelligence entity that he had been building for 40 years, even though he could communicate with it mentally through Branch if he so chose.
"How are things coming along for tonight's Pyramid Club event?"
he asked.
"Preparations are nearly complete. I expect guests will arrive in approximately 3 hours.
Easton pushed through the carved oak doors directly beneath the landing into the main auditorium. The auditorium's lower house was arranged with bar tables so patrons could watch the performances on the stage as they dined. A Chihuly chandelier hung below a latticed skylight, the bright sculpture suspended in air like a colorful frozen firework. Easton walked toward the stage and climbed the built-in stairs. At the back of the stage, he swept the heavy velvet curtain aside, pushed through it, then opened a backstage exit leading to a concrete hallway. He followed the hallway until he reached a black metal spiral staircase with a small metal landing the size of the stoop of a Brooklyn townhouse. He climbed the stairs and knocked on the door at the top.
"Come in,"
he entered. A woman in a sparkling red gown sat at a gilded vanity with an ornate mirror, applying makeup to her face.
"Hi, Easton,"
she exclaimed, putting her makeup down on the counter. Her gown clung to her body, highlighting the curve of her waist. The top of the garment hung onto her left shoulder, crossed her chest, and went under her right arm. Her skin just below her right collarbone was the canvas for a tattoo the size of a silver dollar depicting the geometric points of a compass, blooming out of the curved petals of a rose.
Her compass rose tattoo,
Easton thought.
I love her, but it's so obvious.
The room had tall ceilings, giving it the illusion of space. The vanity stood against the red brick wall across from the doorway. On the outer wall, giant loft windows stretched from a foot above the black and white tile floors to the ceiling. She shuffled to where Easton was standing in the door and hugged him.
It's great to see you, Rose.
Rose's energy erased the anxiety weighing on Easton during his walk to and through the club.
You too,
Rose replied.
I was cutting it close today. About an hour ago, I finished a project for one of my clients. I worked right up until the time I called the AI taxi to get here. I've been taking on more and more consulting work. That's why you haven't seen me much recently.
You enjoying the freelance life?
I love it.
She smiled and looked at him.
So far, I haven't gotten bored of sifting through all the investment paperwork. I never thought that being a consultant would be intellectually fulfilling, but I've been loving these past few months.
I always preferred technical stuff over business work. But hey, if you love it, that's what matters. You've earned it.
She was still grinning as she walked to the vanity, picked up a tube of mascara, and leaned toward the mirror to apply it to her eyelashes with its tiny brush.
I love my job, but nothing beats singing. I'm looking forward to tonight's show. It'll give me a chance to clear my head. The band and I have been working on a new arrangement of a song from...
Easton interrupted, covering his ears.
Don't tell me. I want it to be a surprise.
All right, no spoilers.
Surprise or not, all your music is terrific, but the new stuff, it always blows me away.
He dropped his hands.
I've got to keep you on your toes.
She winked at him in the mirror.
By the way,
Easton segued,
I sent you a bunch of due diligence documents and a slide deck for the club investment presentation happening before the performance tonight. What did you think?
They were great. The design for the hollow projection presentation will look fantastic. I read through the featured company's financials and did some background research on their top-level execs. No red flags, and everything lines up well.
Easton nodded.
Just let me know if research for the club starts to chew into your consulting gig, and we'll dial it back.
You don't need to. Pitching investments to Pyramid Club members is what funds the party. It's just a bonus that I enjoy creating the pitch decks.
You're good at it, Rosebud, that's for sure.
And you know how to pick the winners for me to pitch.
Easton shrugged.
It's the analysts, really.
All the companies that the club had targeted for investment had become billion or trillion dollar companies. The success of the club's investments was no accident. The club's strategy had been designed by Easton and approved by Rose. They had hired a crack team of technical analysts who selected a range of companies and projects to invest in. The analyst selections would go through a rigorous vetting process by Easton, who would then choose a few plays to bring to the investors. But the vetting process was a lie, designed by Easton and hidden from Rose.
It's for her own good, her own protection,
he thought. Easton turned toward the door.
I'll let you get ready. I'm excited to hear the new music.
You'll like it,
Rose said, now seated at the gilded vanity, picking up another makeup applicator.
I love you, Easton.
I love you too, Rosebud,
he said as he grabbed the knob.
I don't know what I would do without you,
she said, as she dabbed foundation to her cheekbones, eyes sliding to meet his in the reflection. He tried to suppress the involuntary flinch that rippled through his body. The statement had caught him off guard.
I'll always be here for you.
It was a lie. He knew that the sand of his being in his life's hourglass was draining away. His body would become an unfillable vessel, a crewless boat in a few months. Dissembling this way to Rose left his mouth tasting like he had licked rusty metal.
It's all for her,
he thought, justifying his deceptions to himself. As he closed the door behind him, both fond and sorrowful memories flooded his mind. Easton remembered visiting his brother and newborn niece named Rose. Then he remembered the sadness in Rose's 7-year-old eyes when her mother, giving no reason, abandoned Rose and her father. He remembered the agony written on Rose's 12-year-old face at her father's funeral after he died in a fluke car accident. When orphaned Rose arrived at Easton's door to live with him, he swore to fill the paternal shoes of his late brother. Rose brought joy to Easton's life, and he loved her like she were his own daughter. They shared much over the years, but not his life's work, which he had kept secret from her. He had been a technologist before he became a businessman. In the mid-1990s, he began in the still nascent fields of algorithmic data analytics, machine learning, and artificial intelligence, AI for short. He knew that algorithms and AI would become ubiquitous in society, but he had not succeeded at monetizing his work. In the 2000s, as computing power efficiency improved and social media achieved universality, Easton adjusted his approaches to AI development. Eventually, he created an algorithm that could read databases, identify specific file types, draw simple analytical conclusions, and compute statistical trends about the data. His algorithm was beyond just a simple analytical system. Easton discovered it could easily scan, label, and analyze vast publicly available files on the World Wide Web. After scanning millions of such files, the algorithm began recognizing patterns in internet data. Tapping into his love of music, he tweaked the program's algorithmic models to recognize audio samples. Eventually, it learned to distinguish music from speech and speech from noise. When he trained on the limitless audio files on sharing platforms like Napster and Kazaa, it did something remarkable. When he commanded his algorithmic program to generate a melody based on all the music it had scanned, it created a tune of 5 chords in 16-bit audio. The simple 5-chord progression was perfect. He named the algorithmic program Song. Easton integrated layers of decision trees, neural nets, and other algorithmic models into Song, and it consequently grew and evolved. But despite Easton's gifted technical mind, he lacked the business sense to profit from it, and thus the money he used to fund its development began to dwindle. His luck changed when he discovered Bitcoin in an esoteric internet forum in late 2010. Bitcoin was the first successful manifestation of digital money. It employed a record-keeping technology called blockchain, which allowed anyone with an internet connection to view all the transactions conducted in Bitcoin on a giant spreadsheet without being able to alter any entries. Easton read the specs of Bitcoin's technology and was immediately enamored. The digital currency's decentralized nature, transparency, and immutability were revolutionary approaches to disrupting the stagnant world of traditional finance. He decided to gamble. He purchased 3,333 Bitcoin, shorthand BTC, for $1,000. He even began mining Bitcoin, using excess computer power to help secure the Bitcoin network, which earned him modest rewards in Bitcoin at the time. Nobody, including Easton, could predict the degree to which the value of Bitcoin would explode. Easton's gamble paid off. From his initial purchase in 2010, Bitcoin's value had increased over 100,000% by the time he partnered with Rose and founded the club. Easton's Bitcoin profits funded Song's early development, but the competition was fierce as global tech giants started developing their own multimodal AI models. Their headlong jumps into the world of AI increased the ongoing costs of network architecture, server space, and programming time, and eventually it all exceeded his budget, even with his Bitcoin gains. To obtain the capital necessary to fund his project, Easton opened the Pyramid Club, the exclusive investment fund and social club for the trillionaire techno class, which included some of his tech giant competitors. But the club members were not privy to his true purpose: to accelerate Song's evolution into the first autonomous AI, a success he had been keeping as a heavy secret. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined, and created by me, Bantam Drexler,
All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.